Welcome to a new episode of The Brand Called You. We have brought some amazing people to you over the year, over the last few months. And today, we have a legend, Pramath Sinha. Pramath, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Pramath is from IIT Kanpur. He's a PhD from UPenn. He was a partner with McKinsey. He's the founding dean and board member of the Indian School of Business. He's the founder of the 9.9 Group, he's founder of Ashoka University and the Young India Fellowship, and he's founder of Harappa, which is a very, very prominent online focused teaching tool. Pramath, welcome.
Thank you so much.
What an amazing journey you've had.
No, thank you. You've set me up for failure by calling me a legend already.
You are. You'll be surprised at how much people follow you and people respect you. So, Pramath, academics obviously seems to be your first love. But before I get into that, you know, you went off overseas, you worked with McKinsey, you chose to come back. Talk to us a little bit about your early journey.
Well, you know, I grew up here in Patna, small town, had a happy childhood in those days.
Yeah.
Things were not as crazy as they are even in these small towns.
Correct.
Went to a good school, got very strong grounding there. Then, of course, I got onto the same treadmill that, unfortunately, young people, even today, it's become worse. You do well, people say you should do science, you should become a doctor, engineer, take coaching, get into IIT. Whether you like it or not, you just go through it. So, I think those were the years when I was basically doing what everybody else was doing. I think the journey took a big twist in my last semester or year at IIT, where we can talk about that later, where I somehow regained an interest in pursuing academia and went to the US. And that was a very foundational and transformative experience, going to a liberal arts university and experiencing the quality of education and the choice and the flexibility and the putting learning back into the students' responsibility. Mm-hmm. That was actually very formative. And then becoming an academic in subsequently, which was what I thought my career would be, became very disappointing because I was so spoiled by the UPenn experience. Luckily for me, McKinsey happened, and that has been a big part of my journey. I think McKinsey in those days, and I think still, was a very transformative personal experience, encouraging you to sort of be, really push yourself from a personal growth perspective. And that gave me the opportunity to build these institutions. Working with Rajat Gupta, who was the head of McKinsey at that time, has also been a very formative experience. Which gave me the courage to take on these projects. And Rajat, having had, I guess, 20 more years on me, was able to show the way and give me the confidence.
And your first venture with him was ISB, isn't it?
Yes. So, he got me involved in ISB very early. And funnily enough, when I think about it, I tried to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had been doing a project in building a university for a McKinsey project in Malaysia. Mm-hmm. Most people don't know that.
Yeah.
My first foray into building educational institutions was for Prime Minister Mahathir,
who's
now come back.
Yeah.
And so we started out by, as a McKinsey project, helping him with transforming the Malaysian economy.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of that project, one of the enablers was to set up a new university. It's called Multimedia University. It's in Malaysia. It has 8,000 students.
In Kuala Lumpur? Or?
Yes, just outside Kuala Lumpur in this area called Cyber Jaya, which we also were instrumental in planning and setting up.
Okay.
So, but, you know, at that time, I didn't quite see this as something I was going to get into. You know, it was part of a larger project of the economic development of the country. And because I had a PhD, people said, "Acha, you do the university part." But then what happened was, once we did the plans and started to build that out, and they then kept calling me back to review progress, mm-hmm. even though I was in India by then. And that's when Rajat caught me in the office one day and said, you know, I have this meeting with the IIT Delhi director. We have to come up with a plan for building a business school for IIT.
And do you have... started with a business school for IIT?
Yes. ISB was really going to be another business school at an IIT. You know, by then, IIT Bombay and IIT Kharagpur both had business schools. The Shailesh Mehta School in Bombay and the Vinod Gupta School in Kharagpur. I think I got that right, or maybe it's the opposite.
Yeah.
So both were alums who had funded and given donations to set up these schools. And the IIT Delhi director at that time, V.S. Raju, had been a professor of Rajat's, and Rajat was getting the Distinguished Alumnus Award. So during that period, he suggested to Rajat that, hey, why don't you help us also with a B school? Look, all your other fellow alums at Kharagpur and Mumbai are setting up B schools, and you pick up head of McKinsey, and you're a trustee at Harvard Business School and Kellogg and so on. So anyway, that's how the idea of the business school was born. And one day in the office, Rajat ran into me and he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm in Malaysia. What are you doing in Malaysia? I'm doing X, Y, Z. And he said, oh, you're an academic. And you're saying, hey, help me set up, put some. And I tried to get out of it saying, listen, I don't have an MBA. And you're talking about a business school. I never did an MBA. So I don't know anything about B schools, what I'm doing in Malaysia as an engineering school. And he said, no, but that's a good thing that, you know, you'll come at it from a fresh perspective. So, you know, these leaders are masters of, turning the argument on your back to you.
Correct. And probably picking the right people, which I think you've also been doing in all your ventures.
That's what I learned from him.
Correct. So, and how did you choose Hyderabad as the location for ISB?
So, that's a long story. At some point, what happened was that we found that we couldn't build the kind of institution we wanted to build in the constraints of the IIT system. And so we decided to come out of the IIT system and build a private B school. The obvious choice was Bombay. And this is all documented in a book I wrote about this. But we were going to be in Bombay for the longest time. We had a site in Bombay. We had architects plan this thing. And we were going to be in the Karkar Hills area in Navi Mumbai. But then we got hit very hard by a requirement for reservation. By Balasaheb Thackeray in those days. We had gone to meet him to ask for some concessions on the user charges that CIDCO was asking us for building the campus.
Yeah.
And people thought that we could approach him. The Shiv Sena government was in power. And when we went to him, he said, of course, we'll help you. But by the way, 50% reservation for Maharashtrians on administration and faculty. And then I don't remember the exact numbers, but some similar. And then we just were shocked that it was not just reservation, but reservation for people from Maharashtra, if we were going to be in Maharashtra. Then we were forced to move out. We then had an opportunity to go to Khadakwasla, but that was still Maharashtra. But at that time, we were really looking to put some pressure on the Maharashtra government. We had no intentions of going anywhere else. Most of our donors were from Bombay. So to put pressure on the Maharashtra government, we started to talk to other governments. And in that process, we ended up going to Hyderabad, where Chandrababu Naidu was the chief minister.
Yeah.
I mean, the confession to make here is that I was working with him as he was my client. And that had actually happened because of the work in Malaysia. So Mahathir had recommended to, you know how life has all these links.
Absolutely.
So Mahathir had recommended that Naidu work with McKinsey. And he had said, there's this Indian guy who worked with me. So Naidu had somehow found McKinsey and me. So once I started working there, I realized that Hyderabad had potential. So on the Naidu side, my McKinsey team was working, pitching to the ISB board to locate the school in Hyderabad. And from the ISB side, I was taking the board to all these places. And so that match worked, and that was an amazing
That's
choice.
A beautiful campus. I've once spoken there.
Yes, of course.
It's a beautiful campus.
Yes. And Naidu really helped us in creating an institution. He then brought in Abdul Kalam as the president-elect for our first convocation. He was instrumental at that time in getting Atal Bihari Vajpayee for our inauguration. So that just put us on a
different level. Yes. So, and all this was happening while you were with McKinsey, and then after that you decide to become an entrepreneur.
Yes.
How did you decide to make this transition?
It's an interesting question, which I haven't had a chance to talk about very much. But you see, what happened was when you were in McKinsey, I was an outlier at McKinsey. I didn't have an MBA. I was recruited as part of a diversified recruiting program. I was treated as the same way as African Americans and women. Mm-hmm. And my category was non-MBA.
Okay.
So McKinsey had this category. But when I got there, I was, you have this very strong imposter syndrome that I'm not trained to be a business guy. I've never been a business guy. And here I am advising people on how to run their businesses. So obviously I'm not qualified and I'm an imposter. So let me just stay in this comfort zone, because in the label of McKinsey, you can keep giving advice even though you know nothing about what you're doing. Obviously, I'm exaggerating the point. You know, McKinsey does teach you a lot of
your track record speaks volumes. I think you've been very modest about it.
No, but what happened was that when I did ISB, I realized that I was not really a consultant. I was a doer, and I enjoyed doing things. And I reflected on my early childhood, when my father would just give me projects all the time. Mm. And while he would always tell us not to do business, he was actually engaged in a business. Mm. I didn't realize that till much later in life. He had a printing press, he had a shop, and we would market his books as kids, and I would go buy paper. So later on, when I realized that actually I have been part of an entrepreneur family, we never talked about it. So I could see why I enjoyed that whole ISB experience. And then when I went back to McKinsey, it was not the same. But, even then, the parents drilling in that business is bad. Don't become a businessman. And your uncle burnt up so much money and so-and-so lost their shirt. So you still have this fear. So the next best thing was that I became the CEO of one of my clients, the Anand Bazar Patrika Group. Offered me the job. And in McKinsey, we used to all take pride in the fact that one day we'll go and run our own organizations and we'll become CEOs. However, that, while it was very attractive, was a bit of a rude shock. I was actually not so great as a CEO trying to transform a company. I was in a hurry. There were clashes with the owners. And I realized that I was spoiled. I realized that I had become, with 13 years in the consulting world, I had become my own person. I wanted to do things my own way, and I had to accept the fact that I was quite set in my ways. That's when I realized that, I really need to be on my own. It's going to be very difficult for me now to work with someone else and be an employee, because I am spoiled. I don't have to be arrogant about it, but I have to accept the fact that there are certain things that I can only do myself. And that's when I said, let's start something.
Young India Fellowship started.
No, so then I started 9.9.
Oh, then you started 9. Okay.
Yeah. So Young India Fellowship came almost 5 years later.
Okay. Yeah. And what was the hypothesis for 9.9?
So
I know you had magazine, because I followed you since then.
Yes.
And
so the hypothesis at 9.9 was, actually, looking back on it, a little bit of a forced hypothesis. And this has been one of my big entrepreneurship lessons. So what happened was, I had to leave ABP in a huff. And this has happened to me a couple of times in my career, where things, things don't go well. You think you're in the right place, and then things don't go well. And so you get out, and then you're left with nothing. And I say, okay, where do I start? So I left. I was left with nothing, and then it was like, okay, I do want to do something on my own. What do I do? I was also feeling like responsible to some of the people I had recruited at ABP. They left. I said, okay, let's join together. So there was five of us trying to build a business. The truth is, we have not one idea, but we had five ideas. And that's the other problem. You can't work on five ideas. So as we were mulling through what to do, I think we made, in retrospect, a big error, which is that you don't become an entrepreneur by being a professional to an idea. Right? So we were really a bunch of professionals looking to do something rather than people who had an idea and said, we want to do this.
Yep.
So one of the former bankers at ABP who had brought a deal to us when I was at ABP came back and said, hey, there's this company that we were trying to sell. It's still available. Why don't you guys take it over? We haven't been able to sell it. It's available at an attractive price. You turn it around and make this the kernel of your business. Now, again, I hadn't lived down my McKinsey experience and I hadn't quite learned the entrepreneurial sort of DNA. So I said, oh, this is a great idea, you know, take something, turn it around, make a business out of it. So we chanced upon or we forced ourselves to become entrepreneurs in the specialty media space. And we continue to do that. I mean, the brands I acquired, you know, Digit and CIO and so on have done well. But, you know, it was a forced fit. And I don't think you can be a forced fit entrepreneur. And I look back on it and the fun that I had building ISB or with Ashoka or now with Harappa. The difference is that these are things that I'm passionate about. I really believe in it.
Yeah.
There it became a little bit of an idea that was given to me. And then I had to do it because, you know, I had investors and so on. So that's a big lesson that I've learned that, you know, don't do entrepreneurship on the back of somebody else's idea or somebody else's business.
So moving now to Ashoka. I mean, I know I've seen you grow it. Lots of friends are involved with you. I mean, in such a short period of time, you have made Ashoka into, if you'll permit me the liberty, the premier university in liberal arts in this country. It's probably the most sought-after university for young people. What have you done that has worked so well? I mean, one of the ingredients is Pramod Sinha himself, but what else have you done?
No, so the first thing I should correct is that it's not Pramod Sinha. I think, and I'm not just being humble, I think Ashish Dhawan, Sanjeev Bikchandani, Chinit Gupta, have been principally involved. There have been others also, and there are quite a few of them. So the credit really does go to the four of us, not just me and the group. And they've been all very, very helpful in pulling this together. However, I would say that for my part, the big contribution really was the learnings that came out of ISB. And also the personal experience that I had had through my education and being an academic and a failed academic. Because I did do a PhD, I did work as an academic, but wasn't successful, then joined McKinsey. So that cumulative experience has been very valuable.
And what were some of these key learnings?
So I'll tell you there were quite a few, but I'll try and highlight a few. See, one of the things that people don't realize is that university education is very different from school education.
Correct.
So at least this is my, I'm not an expert, but this is my impression. I've read a little bit, watched things happen a little bit. School education was always supposed to be to a little bit force things down a kid's mind to say, hey, you need to learn how to spell. You need to learn how to count. You need to learn how the, you know, stars go around the sun, astronomy and so on, geography.
Learn the name of the nine planets.
Correct. So there's something you, and that's what school is. I mean, it's more than that, but for a minute.
Sure.
College was always to help you find yourself. It was to help you find your own voice. It was to help you find your purpose. It was to help you become your own self and take responsibility for your actions. I think as the world has progressed and economic progress has taken place and, you know, skills have advanced, a lot of college has become about building skills. In our country, I think the focus on building technical capabilities about after independence, again, you know, our whole education system was in a way destroyed, which is very unfortunate. We went whole hog into setting up IITs, IIMs, and technical education and skilling became a big part of creating a technocracy. Somewhere we forgot, and this is not just India, around the world, what has happened is college education has become much more about training people for the workforce. And this is the difference I felt when I went from IIT to Penn. Suddenly I realized I had choice. At IIT, because of my JEE rank, I wanted to study in Kanpur because in my days it was the best IIT. I had friends there. But I could only study metallurgical engineering because of my poor rank according to the norms of that time. Now, I studied 4 years of metallurgical engineering with no interest in it. Now, technically, IIT would tell you that, oh, you could have changed. But to change the discipline, you had to pass another exam, which was even more difficult. So what people would do, and you know, people do this in competitive exams in India, they would drop a year, go back and take the exam again, improve the rank, and then come back and do some other department, which they would now deserve. And still not be able to get to the top because, you know, you can't. So here I was having gone through 4 years of something that was forced on me. And there I go to Penn, which is, by the way, a liberal arts institution, which I didn't really understand what it was. So there's an engineering school in a liberal arts place. How does that work? And then when I went to take the classes, people said, well, I said, well, what do I have to study? And they said, well, you decide. I said, what do you mean I decide? They said, well, yeah, you can take a course anywhere. And there are some requirements. And of course, in postgraduate education, there's more flexibility even in India. But the essence was that, going back to my point about discovering yourself in voice, college education does that by giving you choice, by making students pick, by making students understand that, hey, if you don't know what you're going to do, that's normal. You're not confused. You actually have multiple options. This is your age to explore and try. And if you don't like something, then switch. And if you fail at something, that's a very valuable part of your education. So instead of doing this in a sort of prescribed manner, providing an education where you put control, if you can use the word, or choice or decision making back in the hand of the student is the fundamental difference, right? And that's what empowers kids. Kids get excited. There are a large number of kids in this country who know that they have to do BCom or they have to do law. I just rode here with my friend Kapil Mehta, who was telling me that his daughter tried very hard to convince her to go to Ashoka. She said, I'm not going. She went to law school. And that's fine. There are going to be kids who know that. But a large number of kids don't know. So by creating choice for them, you are actually putting them back in charge. And that's very attractive to them. So this is one idea. I think the other thing is very simple. And this is what people forget. All you need to do to create a great institution is put great students and great faculty together. You can put them on a beautiful Hyderabad campus of ISB, or you can put them under a tree in your
parampara.
Magic will happen. But then you have to be relentless and you have to be absolutely strict about not compromising the quality standards.
I agree. But, you know, I know a lot of young students who are studying at Ashoka. And yet, one of the things, I mean, you know, you and I are of the same vintage. And we've been brought up in a certain way based on examinations and pressures and so on and so forth. And as you said, IIT, you know, we've all had to go through that. And I guess that was the time how India was maturing. But I see the same kind of pressure on a lot of children who are finishing school. Ashoka has, you know, probably removed that so-called pressure cooker situation for a small group of people who can get in. But what is the answer to the thousands and thousands of students coming out in our country in the same situation? We hear horror stories from those coaching institutes of Kota and the other places?
You know, I think this is the tyranny of the numbers. Mm. What has happened is that our population has created a situation where fundamentally the existing models of education do not work. Mm. So the classroom teacher model with X number of classrooms and X number of students to a classroom to a teacher mm. was the model that was prevalent for the maybe even the last 1,000 years. That model doesn't work in a country that is giving birth to 25 million children a year.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Who all deserve a high quality education.
Correct.
So that explosion we have not anticipated in the model of our education system. Mm. Therefore there's a massive scarcity and supply demand mismatch. The only thing we have done to take care of that scarcity is try to say, no, we have to be very meritocratic. Otherwise, people will take advantage of the supply demand mismatch. These black marketeers will set up universities and gouge students, which is happening. So then to control that, from there to be a runaway bad situation, we say, no, we'll control this. So we put in lots of controls, but those controls are meant for the worst offender.
Yeah.
And those controls are then applied to
everybody.
So now the problem is that there is no flexibility in the system. For innovation. There is no reason that there should be one entrance test for all IITs.
Mm.
The way you want to free it up is you want to tell all 23 IITs that, hey, you're a national level institution. Why should you all have the same entrance? Mm. You decide what kind of student you want.
Correct.
You decide what kind of student you want.
Yeah.
And that's the way it works all over the world.
Mm.
In fact, if you ask me, it's a solved problem.
Mm.
What problem are we trying to solve? This is the solved problem is that the best universities of the world decide for themselves. You don't prescribe to them. Nobody owns them. Right? Now, you may say, well, Pramath, what about the problem of the bootleggers and the black marketeers? I think absolutely control them. But then free up the ones that who are to be trusted.
Yeah.
Right? You don't have to free up everybody. But this whole idea of the institutions of eminence was exactly that. That if you trust that Ashutosh will set up a university which is not self-serving, that is not commercially oriented, let him do it.
Mm.
Tell him that, of course we'll monitor you, put guidelines, you can't still rook students.
Mm.
But I'll give you the freedom to do innovation. And that's what ISB and Ashoka and many of the new universities are doing. Within the system, we are saying, listen, we can choose to also say, show me your JE score or show me your CAT score or whatever. We are not doing that. We are saying, listen, we'll take your score, but we will look at you because we want people who are interested, who are interesting, who are more holistic, and it would at least give people a chance.
Right. So, look at the irony of this whole thing. On the one side, there are people who are not getting jobs. And when I speak to people in companies, they say, we can't find the people who can't get jobs, who are suitable for jobs. Or we keep saying that we are not getting good enough educational institutions. And yet, when I drive from here to UP,
see,
dozens of colleges which are lying empty. What is the solution? I mean, there has to be some answer that has to be found, because you said rightly, 25 million adding to the birth cohort every year.
So, firstly, this problem has not existed before. So, you need to find new solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not suggesting that I have answers.
No.
But I think one is that we need a massive overhaul of the whole system. It's the kind of transformational reforms that India saw in 1991 with respect to our economy, where we said, okay, we'll do almost a reboot. And if you look at our history as a country, or I would say even as a civilization, then real economic independence happened.
Yep.
So I think you need that kind of a reboot. What are some elements of that? I think some of these are bringing in practices that are solved problems. So for example, everywhere in the world, including the United States, where we send all our children these days, there are three tiers and four tiers of institutions. Most of our kids are going to those top 100 institutions. They are not going to the remaining 700-800 institutions in the United States. So how do you build those first few institutions who really do become the at the forefront of leading stuff? China has done that. They started with a C9 program where they picked 9 universities and said, we'll make them the best in the world. That, when they were able to put on enough of a momentum, they've created a C32 program. So now they have expanded that list of 9 to 32. Russia has the top 500 program. So they say, we'll take 5 universities and push them up to become top 100 by 2020. So this idea that you have a tiered structure is very important. I think that's an old solution, but still relevant. I think the second is, and this is what I'm trying to do with Harappa, and let's see, if you look at my own example, I've been now doing this for about 20 years. If you add up all the institutions that I've involved with, the total intake a year will not cross 3,000. And I'm talking about a dozen institutions in India that I'm associated with. Now, you can't have impact in this old bricks and mortar model. So the answer does lie in using technology smartly. And you haven't seen that happen. The effort so far, I mean, it's the equivalent of the IGNU. You'll be surprised how many people take IGNU degrees just to somehow educate themselves. And it's sad because, you know, I've been looking at some of the content that is out there. It's not of the quality. So I do think that using technology in a blended, hybrid, pure, online, digital, call it what you will, model, is the only way you can reach so many people.
Yes.
And for us, it's like, oh, how can you replace classrooms with technology? But, you know, it's the same thing as automobiles and horse carts. It's the same thing as blackboard versus verbal learning. It's the same thing as books and laptops versus what was taught verbally. It's the same kind of transformation that is going to happen. You know, decades from now, people will take, you know, online learning as normal as reading a book.
That's true. So I've got one more question before we get into a few questions on you personally. You know, research. You went to do your research to the US. People always say that research is a driver for excellence in academics. And India, I think, I could be wrong, lags woefully behind in research. What can be done to improve research in our institutions?
So this is again, I think, a solved problem which we have kind of ignored. You know what? We were known for research. And if you look at our scientists, even post-independence, there were the Boses and the Babas of the world who were world class. No doubt about that. The institutions we set up, the DIFR, the IISc, were all world class. And you know what? People don't realize that higher education and research is by definition an elite thing. You know, not everybody can't be getting a college education and everybody can't be doing research. And that's how other people have done it. Research, fundamental basic research, has to be supported by public funds. Public funds will always be under pressure. Now, you can get some private funds, but ultimately it's the large public good that comes out of research and therefore it has to be funded by the commercial interests will never fund long-term fundamental research. It's a mismatch of objectives.
Yep.
Now, if you have scarce resources, you can't spread it. You have to concentrate it. Somewhere along the way in our philosophy, we started to democratize research. And we became uncomfortable with the idea that only some people will have access to this very high quality and that it will become elitist. Doesn't have to become elitist, but it is elite. It is limited to a few individuals. We as a country cannot afford to spread our resources. So now we've gone to an extreme situation where we require every institution and every faculty member to do research. And we are spreading our resources thin. So I think that is the problem. And I think that can only be solved if the government says, listen, please don't everybody want to do research. If you want to do research, go to raise funds from others. We will fund only these many institutions to do this research. And by the way, that's how the National Science Foundation in the United States works, even with all the resources that they have. This is how funding works in Canada, in Europe. A few people get research grants, a few institutions and a few people associated with those institutions get to do research grants. And of course, our industry, therefore, has also not really imbibed the, you know, the innovation. And that's a whole different issue which we can talk about. But I think the taking scarce resources and concentrating them is the answer. I think we absolutely have the ability to do cutting-edge research.
So I've got only two more questions given our time. One question is from the perspective of your being an entrepreneur. What would your advice be to a lot of young people who want to start off as entrepreneurs?
Well, two or three things.
Yeah.
And this is not my own insights, but what I've learned from others. My friend Sanjeev Bikchandani always tells me that, you know, you have to be solving a real problem. So don't become obsessed with some idea you came up with and then go around trying to fit that solution into a...
Correct.
Look for a problem for your solution.
Correct.
So find a real problem to solve and let the solution draw customers or revenues or whatever. I think what has happened is in the current age with valuations and funding and so on, that people are quite happy to create numbers by throwing money at it.
Correct.
And they think that's what it is to build a business. I think building a business is still back to what it was earlier. What is the real problem? And do people get attracted to your solution as a bull rather than you pushing it?
Absolutely.
I think the only second thing I will say, and this came out of some of the work I used to do in McKinsey when the first dot-com bubble happened, we were trying to understand entrepreneurship.
In the late
90s. Yes, in the late 90s. One of the things I remember being struck by in those days, by I did a lot of interviews of successful entrepreneurs, is that entrepreneurship is also like a profession. So when you become an entrepreneur, it's not about the wonderful idea you have. In fact, in 99% of the cases, the idea you start with doesn't work. You realize very quickly that you hadn't thought it through it won't work. And now the word is pivot. So, you know, have to change or... So you can't be wedded to the idea. You have to be wedded to the idea of entrepreneurship.
Correct.
That, you know, I really want to build something. I really want to create an institution. I really want to have my own mark on the world. And be driven by that. And of course, ideas will come and go. And, you know, you have to pick an idea too. Earlier I said that you are passionate about and you really feel strongly about. You shouldn't just take somebody else's idea. But don't be also so wedded to an idea that you are not, you realize that, okay, I will now go do something else. So a lot of people come to me and say, hey, I have this wonderful idea. I'm going to try it out. And you know what? If it doesn't work, I'll go back to a job. Then that gives me the first signal that this person shouldn't become an entrepreneur. That you should be prepared that that idea will not work. And if you're saying I'll go back to a job, then there's a good chance it won't work. So that determination is very important.
Very true. And my last question, Pramod. I love asking this to all my guests. Tell me your biggest learning from your biggest failure.
Or your
learning from your failure.
So, I think the biggest learning that I've had is that when you fail, there are people who will blame you. And there are people who will make you feel like you stood up, that the problem is you, that you didn't do something or you did something bad because of what you did. And you can contrast that with people who will say, okay, there's been a failure, let's solve for the failure. Let's take care of whatever the negative impact is of the mistake you made or what you did wrong. Then let's come back and sit down and say, what did you learn from it? And how do we make sure that we understand what your role was it, what external circumstances led to it, and how do you move on from here so that you can be better next time? I have learned that being the second person is obviously the best way to be.
Absolutely.
That has helped me in my career, where people I really look up to have given me that chance. It has made me followers of these people for life. And I hope it has made me also like them in the way I deal with people. It's not easy. I think I'm not perfect. I think I might sometimes show displeasure or show reaction which is inappropriate in this kind of situation. But at least I try not to let people be blamed or discouraged or feel demotivated when they fail. And I think that is something that I feel has been a big learning for myself, and then to in how I deal with other people.
Fantastic. Pramod, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think you have been absolutely incredible in how honestly you have shared so much. And I sincerely hope everything that you have done can be used at a national level. I think India will win if a lot of your ideas, and to use your own term, it's a solved problem. I love those two words, and I hope we can do it.
Thank you
very much.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for The Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.